immigrant detainment centers, the pillaging of native lands. I began to widen. I was unlearning the whitewashed version of American history I'd been indoctrinated into believing. I was discovering that I was not who I imagined myself to be. I was learning that my country was not what I had been taught it was. This experience of learning and unlearning reminded me of getting sober from addiction. When I started to really listen and think more deeply about the experiences of people of color and other marginalized people in our country, I felt like I did when I first quit drinking, increasingly uncomfortable as the truth agitated my comfortable numbness. I felt ashamed as I began to learn all the ways my ignorance and silence had hurt other people. I felt exhausted because there was so much more to unlearn, so many amends to be made, and so much work to do. Just like in my early days of sobriety from booze, in my early days of sobriety from white supremacy, I felt shaky, jumpy, and agitated as I slowly surrendered the privilege of not knowing. It was a painful unbecoming. Eventually, it became time to speak up. I started sharing the voices I was reading and speaking out against the racism of America's past and the bigotry and strategic divisiveness of the current administration. Every time I did this, people got pissed off. I felt okay about this because I seemed to be pissing off the right people. Much later, I was asked to participate in an activist group led by women of color. One of the Black leaders tasked another white woman and me with the job of planning an online webinar for other white women with the intention of calling them into the work of racial justice. Our mission was twofold: begin educating other white women and solicit donations to fund bail and respite for Black activists putting themselves on the line day after day. The other white woman and I accepted the job. On our planning calls for the webinar, we decided that she would focus on the history of complicity of white women, and I would focus on my personal experience as a white woman waking up to her place inside of white supremacy. I thought that if I explained to white women that the confusion, shame, and fear they would experience in their early days of racial sobriety were predictable parts of the process of unbecoming, they would be more likely to remain in the anti-racism effort. Also, they'd be better equipped to confront their racism privately instead of mistakenly believing that their feelings should be shared publicly. This felt important because Black leaders were telling me that the ignorance and emotionality of well-intentioned white women was a major stumbling block toward justice. I knew what they meant. I'd seen it happen again and again. If white women don't learn that our experiences in early racial sobriety are predictable, we think our reactions are unique. So we enter race conversations far too early and we lead with our feelings and confusion and opinions. When we do this, we are centering ourselves, so we inevitably get put back where we belong, which is far from the center. This makes us even more agitated. We are used to people showing gratitude for our presence, so being unappreciated hurts our feelings. We double down. We say things like, "At least I'm trying. No one is even grateful. All I do is get attacked." People become upset because saying, "I am being attacked," doesn't accurately describe what is happening. People are just telling us the truth for the first time. That truth feels like an attack because we have been protected by comfortable lies for so long. We are dumbfounded. We feel like we are always saying the wrong things and that people are always getting upset about that. But I do not think that people become upset just because we say the wrong things. I think people are upset and we are defensive, hurt, and frustrated because we have fallen into the trap of believing that becoming racially sober is about saying the right thing instead of becoming the right thing. That showing up is based in performing instead of transforming. The way we show up reveals that we haven't yet done the studying and listening required to become the right thing before trying to say the right thing. We are mugs filled to the brim, and we keep getting bumped. If we are filled with coffee, coffee will spill out. If we are filled with tea, tea will spill out. Getting bumped is inevitable. If we want to change what spills out of us, we have to work to change what's inside of us. How do I enter the race conversation is the wrong question in the early days of racial sobriety. We are not talking about a conversation to enter publicly as much as a conversion to surrender to privately. Whether we are in it to perform or to transform becomes evident by the way we take up space. When a white woman who is unbecoming does show up publicly, she does so with humble respect, which is a way of being that is quiet, steady, and yielding. Not with hand-wringing shame, because self-flagellation is just another way to demand attention. She has feelings, but she interrogates them within, instead of imposing them on others, because there is a deep understanding that how she feels is irrelevant when people are dying. I plan to share all of this on the webinar. My hope was that it might prepare participants for the early stages of racial sobriety and that this preparation might serve the larger social justice efforts of our activist group. We sent the plans for our webinar out to the leaders of our group for feedback and approval. We made their suggested adjustments, then posted online about the seminar. Thousands registered. I went to bed. The next morning, I woke up to a text from a friend that said, "Gee, just checking on you. I'm watching what's going down online. Let me know that you're okay." My heart sank as I opened up Instagram. There were hundreds, eventually thousands of comments, many of them from people calling me a racist. What I didn't know back then is that there are several valid and contradictory schools of thought about how white women should show up in the racial justice movement. One view: white women, when accountable to and led by women of color, should use our voices and platforms to call other white women into anti-racism work. Another view: white women should only use their voices to point to people of color already doing the work. Those who subscribed to the latter philosophy were furious with me about this webinar. Why would you try to teach instead of pointing toward women of color who are already doing this work? Why would you take up space in this movement when so many women of color have been doing this work forever? You offering a free course is taking money out of Black educators' pockets. Offering a safe space for white women to talk about race is wrong. White women don't need to be safe. They need to be educated. You are canceled. You are a racist. You are a racist, Glennon. You are nothing but a racist. Everywhere, the word racist. I was stunned. I am not new to criticism. I am a woman who announced her engagement to a woman during a countrywide Christian speaking tour. I have been publicly ridiculed by and excommunicated from entire religious denominations. I'm used to the other side hating me. I wear that kind of backlash as a badge of honor. But friendly fire was new and excruciating. I felt idiotic and remorseful. I also felt terribly jealous of every single person who had decided to sit this one out. I thought of the quote, "It is better to be quiet and thought a fool than to open your mouth and prove it." I felt defensive, hurt, frustrated, and afraid. I could not think of a single thing I was more terrified of being called than a racist. This was rock bottom. Luckily, I am a woman who has learned repeatedly that while rock bottom feels like the end, it's always the beginning of something. I knew that this was the moment I'd either relapse with a couple shots of self-pity and resignation, or I'd double down on my racial sobriety and carry on. I told myself, breathe. Don't panic and flee. Sink. Feel it all. Be still. Imagine. Let it burn. Eventually, I started remembering. Each night when I was growing up, my family would sit down on our basement couch and watch the evening news together. It was the time of the war on drugs. I lived in the suburbs, but in the cities, things were clearly terrible. The news insisted that crack was everywhere, and so were so-called crack babies and welfare queens. Night after night, we watched young Black bodies thrown to the ground, rounded up en masse, pushed into cop cars. After the nightly news, the show Cops aired. along with millions of other American families, my family would sit and watch Cops together. Every night, I'd see mostly white cops arresting mostly poor black men. For entertainment, we would eat popcorn while we watched. 30 years later, after the Charleston massacre, my parents' rural Virginia town buzzed about how to respond to the racial issues agitating Americans' consciousness. A local church invited the community to come together and address it. My parents decided to attend. They sat in a large room with about 100 other white folks. A woman stood up to bring the meeting to order. She announced that she and a few other women had decided to respond by sending care packages to the predominantly black school across town. She suggested that they break up into groups and choose items to collect. The room exhaled in relief. Yes, outward action, performance instead of transformation. Our insides are safe. My father was confused and frustrated. He raised his hand. The woman called on him. My dad stood and said, "I'm not here to make packages. I'm here to talk." I was raised in a racist southern town. I was taught a lot of things about black people that I've been carrying in my mind and my heart for decades. I'm starting to understand that not only are these lies, but they're deadly lies. I don't want to pass this poison down to my grandkids' generation. I want this stuff out of me, but I don't know how to get it out. I think I'm saying that I've got racism in me, and I want to unlearn it. My father is a man who spent his entire career in schools championing kids who didn't look like me. He is a man who taught us every single day that racism is evil. But he now understood that a person can be good and still be sick. My father understood that there is such a thing in America as a highly functioning racist. He'd become humble enough to learn that we can be good, kind, justice-loving people in our hearts and minds, but if we live in America, we're poisoned by the racist air we breathe. He had dared to imagine that he played a role in our sick American family. He was ready to let burn his cherished idea of good white person. He was ready to stay in the room and turn himself inside out. I am a feminist, but I was raised in a sexist culture. I was raised in a world that tried to convince me through media, religious organizations, history books, and the beauty industry that female bodies are worth less than male bodies, and that certain types of female bodies, thin, tall, young, are worth more than other types of female bodies. The images of women's bodies for sale, the onslaught of emaciated women's bodies held up as the pinnacle of female achievement, and the pervasive message that women exist to please men is the air I breathed. I lived in a mine, and the toxin was misogyny. I got sick from it. Not because I'm a bad sexist person, but because I was breathing misogynistic air. I became bulimic, and it's taken me a lifetime to recover. Self-hatred is harder to unlearn than it is to learn. It is difficult for a woman to be healthy in a culture that is still so very sick. It is the ultimate victory for a woman to find a way to love herself and other women while existing in a world insisting that she has no right to. So I'm working hard at health and wholeness every day. I'm an advocate for women's equality because at my roots, I know the truth. I know what my body is for. It's not for men's use. It's not for selling things. It's for loving and learning and resting and for fighting for justice. I know that everybody on this earth has equal, unsurpassable worth. And yet, I still have the poison in me. I still have all of the biases that were instilled in me for decades. I still struggle to love my body every single day. 50% of all of my daily thoughts are about my body. I still step on the scale to check my self-worth. Subconsciously, I would likely still judge a thinner, younger woman to be worth more than a heavy, older woman. I know that often my knee-jerk reaction is not my wild, it's my taming, so I can correct that misguided first judgment, but it takes me a deliberate effort. We become the air we breathe. When I was 35, I noticed that the wrinkles on my forehead were deepening, and I found myself driving to a doctor's office and paying hundreds of dollars to have Botox poison painfully injected into my forehead to make my face worth as much as the younger, smoother faces on TV. I quite literally knew better, but my subconscious did not know better. My subconscious had not yet caught up with my mind and my heart because it was, is still, poisoned. It took a conscious decision to stop poisoning myself, to stop paying to have misogyny injected beneath my skin. I am a fierce, forever feminist, but I still have sexism and misogyny running through my veins. You can be one thing, and your subconscious can be another thing. I talk to women all the time about how misogyny pumped into the air by our culture affects us deeply, how it corrupts our ideas about ourselves and pits women against each other, how that programmed poison makes us sick and mean, how we all have to work hard to detox from it so that we don't keep hurting ourselves and other women. Women cry and nod and say, "Yes, yes, me too. I've got misogyny in me and I want it out." No one is terrified to admit she has internalized misogyny because there is no morality attached to the admission. No one decides that being affected by misogyny makes her a bad person. When a woman says she wants to work to detox herself of misogyny, she is not labeled a misogynist. It is understood that there is a difference between a misogynist and a person affected by misogyny who is actively working to detox. They both have misogyny in them, programmed by the system, but the former is using it to wield power to hurt people, and the latter is working to untangle herself from its power so she can stop hurting people. But then, when I bring up racism, the same women say, "But I'm not racist. I'm not prejudiced. I was raised better than that." We are not going to get the racism out of us until we start thinking about racism like we think about misogyny. Until we consider racism as not just a personal moral failing, but as the air we've been breathing. How many images of Black bodies being thrown to the ground have I ingested? How many photographs of jails filled with Black bodies have I seen? How many racist jokes have I swallowed? We have been deluged by stories and images meant to convince us that Black men are dangerous, Black women are dispensable, and Black bodies are worth less than white bodies. These messages are in the air and we've just been breathing. We must decide that admitting to being poisoned by racism is not a moral failing, but denying we have poison in us certainly is. Revelation must come before revolution. Becoming sober from booze, patriarchy, white supremacy is a little bit like swallowing the blue pill and slowly watching the invisible, deliberate matrix we've been living inside become visible. For me, the process of detoxing from booze included becoming aware of the matrix of consumer culture that brainwashed me into believing that my pain was to be numbed through consumption. Detoxing from my eating disorder meant seeing the web of patriarchy that trained me to believe that I was not allowed to be hungry or take up space on the earth. And detoxing from racism is requiring me to open my eyes to the elaborate web of white supremacy that exists to convince me that I am better than people of color. In America, there are not two kinds of people, racists and non-racists. There are three kinds of people. Those poisoned by racism and actively choosing to spread it, those poisoned by racism and actively trying to detox, and those poisoned by racism who deny its very existence inside them. I've decided that the people who called me a racist were right and wrong. I am the second type of person. I am a white woman who has come to the conclusion that the reason people call me a racist when I show up to speak about racism is that I am showing up as I am and I have racism in me. By what I say and don't say, by the way I say it, people can see my inner racism on the outside. What they are seeing and pointing out is the truth. Every white person who shows up and tells the truth, because it's her duty as a member of our human family, is going to have her racism called out. She will have to accept that others will disagree with how she's showing up and that they will have every right to disagree. She will need to learn to withstand people's anger, knowing that much of it is real and true and necessary. She will need to accept that one of the privileges she's letting burn is her emotional comfort. She will need to remind herself that being called a racist is actually not the worst thing. The worst thing is privately hiding her racism to stay safe, liked, and comfortable while others suffer and die. There are worse things than being criticized, like being a coward. I'm afraid to put these thoughts inside a book that will not be in people's hands until a year from now. I know that I will later read this and see the racism in it that I cannot see right now. But I think of the words of Dr. Maya Angelou: do the best you can until you know better. Then, when you know better, do better. Doing our best now is an active thing, and so is knowing better. We don't show up and then wait to magically know better. We show up and then, when we are corrected, we keep working. We listen hard so we can know better next time. We seek out teachers so we can know better next time. We let burn our ideas about how good and well-meaning we are so we can become better next time. Learning to know better is a commitment. We will only know better if we continue unbecoming. So I will commit to showing up with deep humility and doing the best I can. I will keep getting it wrong, which is the closest I can come to getting it right. When I'm corrected, I will stay open and keep learning. Not because I want to be the wokest woke who ever woked, but because people's children are dying of racism, and there is no such thing as other people's children. Our hidden racism is destroying and ending lives. It's making police officers kill black men at 3 times the rate of white men. It's making lawmakers limit funding for clean water and poison children. It's making doctors allow black women to die during or after childbirth at 3 to 4 times the rate of white women. It's making school officials suspend and expel black students at 3 times the rate of white students. It's making judges incarcerate black drug users at nearly 6 times the rate of white drug users. Programmed hidden racism is deadly. The fact that this poison was pumped into us may not be our fault, but getting it out is sure as hell our responsibility. So when the moment comes, whether it's about my family, my community, or my country, when the energy shifts to me and the question is asked of me, how do you imagine you might be contributing to our sickness? I want to stay in the room. I want to feel, to imagine, to listen, to work. I want to turn myself inside out to help clear our air. Questions. Recently, I was holding a town hall type event in the Midwest. There were 1,000 women in the audience, a smattering of men, a few gurgling babies. After we opened up the event for questions, I noticed a hand slowly rise in the back of the room. A runner hurried to the back, slid along the pew, and asked the owner of the hand to stand. A woman with short gray hair and a gentle, serious face with deep wrinkles slowly stood. She wore a sweatshirt with an American flag and the word grandma puffy painted onto it. Her hand shook a little as she held the mic. I loved her instantly. She said, "Hi, Glennon. I've been following your work for 10 years, and I came here to ask you a question that I'm afraid to ask anyone else. I feel confused. My nephew is now my niece. I adore him. I'm sorry, her. My granddaughter took a boy to homecoming last year and a girl this year. And now you're gay too? I don't mean any offense. It's just, why is everybody so gay all of a sudden?" The room fell still and silent. The sea of heads that was turned toward this woman slowly turned back toward me. Eyes were wide. I felt the room's collective stress for her, for me, for all of us. Oh, God. Was that offensive? Was that wrong? Is Glennon pissed? But also, why is everybody so gay all of a sudden?
They were worried that we'd just crashed and burned. I knew we'd finally taken off. Blessed are those brave enough to make things awkward, for they wake us up and move us forward. I said, "Thank you for asking a question most are too afraid to admit they have. Unasked questions become prejudices. Your niece and granddaughter are lucky to have you. Will you tell me your name?"
"Joanne."
"Okay. I do know why everybody's so gay all of a sudden. It's those damn GMOs, Joanne." A wave of relieved laughter washed over the entire church. Some ladies laughed so hard that tears rolled down their faces, and we all had ourselves one giant, collective, organic baptism. When the laughter died down, I suggested that we all take a deep breath. It felt so good to laugh and then breathe together. Everything doesn't have to be so terrifying after all. This is just life, and we are just people trying to figure each other out, trying to figure ourselves out. After our breath, I said something like this: "There are wild, mysterious forces inside and between human beings that we have never been able to understand. Forces like faith, like love, like sexuality. We are uncomfortable with our inability to comprehend or control these mysteries. So we took wild faith, the mysterious, undefinable, ever-shifting flow between humans and the divine, and we packaged it into religions. We took wild sexuality, the mysterious, undefinable, ever-shifting flow between human beings, and we packaged it into sexual identities. It's like water in a glass. Faith is water. Religion is a glass. Sexuality is water. Sexual identity is a glass. We created these glasses to try to contain uncontainable forces. Then we said to people, pick a glass, straight or gay. By the way, choosing the gay glass will likely leave you unprotected by the law, ostracized by your community, and banished by God. Choose wisely. So folks poured their wide, juicy selves into those narrow, arbitrary glasses because that was what was expected. Many lived lives of quiet desperation, slowly suffocating as they held their breath to fit inside. Somewhere, sometime, someone, for whatever courageous, miraculous reason, finally acknowledged her dragon. She decided to trust what she felt, to know what she knew, and to dare to imagine an unseen order where she might be free. She refused to contain herself any longer. She decided to speak her insides on the outside and just let it burn. She raised her hand and said, "Those labels don't feel true to me. I don't want to squeeze myself inside either of those glasses. For me, that's not exactly it. I'm not sure what it is yet, but it's not that." Someone else heard the first brave one speak and felt electric hope flowing through his veins. He thought, "Wait, what if I'm not alone? What if I'm not broken at all? What if the glasses system is broken?" He felt his hand rise and voice rise with a "me too." Then another person's hand slowly rose, and then another and another, until there was a sea of hands, some shaking, some in fists, a chain reaction of truth, hope, and freedom. I don't think that gayness is contagious, but I am certain that freedom is. In the name of freedom, we added more glasses. We said, "Okay, I hear you. Those other glasses don't fit, so here's a bisexual glass for you. And for you, how about a pansexual glass?" We kept adding labeled glasses for every letter of the LGBTQ until it felt like we'd eventually use up the whole alphabet. This was better, but not exactly right, because some glasses still came with fewer rights and greater burdens, and some people, like me, still couldn't find a glass that fit. My hunch is that folks have always been 50 shades of gay. I wonder if instead of adding more glasses, we should stop trying to contain people within them. Perhaps, eventually, we'll rid ourselves of the glass system altogether. Faith, sexuality, and gender are fluid. No glasses. All see. But letting go of structures can feel uncomfortable and disorienting. Rumbling freedom is scary because at first it feels like chaos. Pronouns and bathrooms and girls taking girls to prom, oh my. But progress is just perpetually undoing our no longer true enough systems in order to create new ones that more closely fit people as they really are. People aren't changing, after all. It's just that for the first time, there's enough freedom for people to stop changing who they are. Progress is the acknowledgement of what is and what has always been. Progress is always a returning. Maybe we can stop trying so hard to understand the gorgeous mystery of sexuality. Instead, we can just listen to ourselves and each other with curiosity and love and without fear. We can just let people be who they are, and we can believe that the freer each person is, the better we all are. Maybe our understanding of sexuality can become as fluid as sexuality itself. We can remember that no matter how inconvenient it is for us to allow people to emerge from their glasses and flow, it's worth it. Our willingness to be confused, open, and kind will save lives. Maybe courage is not just refusing to be afraid of ourselves, but refusing to be afraid of others too. Maybe we can stop trying to find common ground and let everybody be the sea. They already are anyway. Let it be. Permission slips. A fundamentalist Christian organization recently announced that I was excommunicated from the Evangelical Church. I learned of this with great amusement. I felt like Kramer from Seinfeld when his boss tries to fire him from a job he never really had. "You can't fire me," Kramer says, baffled and defiant. "I don't even really work here." I was talking to a friend about this, and she said, "It's so awful. Why can't they understand that you were born this way? You can't help it. How cruel to punish you for something you can't even change." I thought. That's not exactly it. Sometimes we say things that we believe are loving but actually reveal our conditioning. Things you can't help are things you would help if you could. If I could change my sexuality, I sure as hell wouldn't. Sweet Jesus, I love sharing my life with a woman. I love how relentlessly we yearn to understand each other and how neither of us quits until we do. I love how we already do understand each other so well because we are two women trying to free ourselves from the same cages. I love how our life together is one eternal conversation that we put on pause only to sleep. I love having sex with my wife. I love the touches that are suggestions, and I love the moment we lock eyes and decide. I love how well we understand each other's bodies, and I love the liquid velvet of her skin. I love the softness, intensity, patience, and generosity of the during, and I love the after, the time outside of time, when we lie in each other's arms in silence and smile at the ceiling in relief and gratitude. I love how one of us inevitably giggles and says, "Is this really our life?" I have been in a mixed-gender marriage and in a same-gender marriage. The same-gender marriage feels so much more natural to me because there is no constant effort to bridge the gap between two genders that have been trained by our culture to love and live so differently. My wife and I are on the same side of the bridge already. Being married to Abby is arriving home after a long, cold, exhausting journey. She is the crackling fireplace, the shag rug, the couch I sink into, the blanket wrapped around me, and the jazz playing in the background that makes me shiver inside the blanket. What I want to say is, what if I wasn't born this way at all? What if I married Abby not just because I'm gay, but because I'm smart? What if I did choose my sexuality and my marriage? And they are simply the truest, wisest, most beautiful, most faithful, most divine decisions I've ever made in my entire life. What if I have come to see same-gender love as a really solid choice? Just a brilliant idea. Something I would highly recommend. And what if I demand freedom, not because I was born this way and can't help it, but because I can do whatever I choose to do with my love and my body from year to year, moment to moment, because I'm a grown woman who does not need any excuse to live however I want to live and love whomever I want to love? What if I don't need your permission slip because I'm already free? Concessions. Recently, Abby, the kids, and I were lying on the couch together, watching one of our favorite family shows. During an intense scene, it became clear that the family's teenage daughter was about to tell her parents that she was queer. She and her parents stood around their kitchen island, and she said, "I have to tell you something. I like girls." In the pause that followed, the TV parents and all five of us on the couch collectively held our breath. The mother took her daughter by the hand and said, "We love you." I whispered, "Don't say it. Don't say it. Don't say it. No matter what." "Damn it," she said it. I knew this show was trying to be progressive, to prove that these parents embraced their daughter's gayness just as much as they'd embrace her straightness. I wondered, though, if this girl had just told her parents that she liked boys, would the mother have said, "We love you no matter what"? Of course not. Because no matter what is what we say when someone has disappointed us. If my son got caught cheating on a test, I'd dole out a consequence and then assure him that I love him no matter what. If my daughter told me that she'd just robbed a bank, I'd hold her hand and tell her that I love her no matter what. The no matter what would imply that even though my child had done something that fell short of my expectations, my love is still strong enough to hold her. When it comes to who my children are, I don't want to be an expectations parent. I don't want my kids striving to meet an arbitrary list of preconceived goals I have created for them. I want to be a treasure hunt parent. I want to encourage my children to spend their lives digging, uncovering more and more about who they already are, and then sharing what they discover with those lucky enough to be trusted by them. When my child uncovers a gem inside and pulls it out for me to see, I want to widen my eyes and gasp and applaud. In other words, if my daughter told me she was gay, I would not love her in spite of it. I would love her because of it. What if parenting became less about telling our children who they should be and more about asking them again and again forever who they already are? Then, when they tell us, we would celebrate instead of concede. It's not, "I love you no matter which of my expectations you meet or don't meet." It's, "My only expectation is that you become yourself. The more deeply I know you, the more beautiful you become to me." If someone tells you who they are, consider how lucky you are to be graced with that gift. Don't respond with an eviction notice, a permission slip, or a concession speech. Un-God yourself. Gasp in awe and applaud with gusto.
Knots for Abby. Tonight, you and I are in a minister's office somewhere in Texas. We're chatting before I go out to speak to the waiting crowd. You don't like these steepled, echoing rooms. You come with me anyway. You sit in the front pew and listen to me talk about God and the hunches I have about her. You think I'm wrong to believe there's a God. But it's what you love and need me for. You borrow my faith like we borrow our next-door neighbor's Wi-Fi. This minister said something that made you feel safe. You looked down at your hands. You said, "I don't feel comfortable in churches. When I was little, I knew I was gay. I had to choose church, my mom and God, or myself. I chose myself." "Damn right," the minister said. She cleared her throat. I smiled at her. But "damn right" wasn't exactly it. I turned to you, touched your hand. I said, "Babe, wait. Yes. When you were little, your heart turned away from the church in order to protect itself. You remained whole instead of letting them dismember you. You held on to who you were born to be instead of contorting yourself into who they told you to be. You stayed true to yourself instead of abandoning yourself. When you shut down your heart to that church, you did it to protect God in you. You did it to keep your wild. You thought that decision made you bad, but that decision made you holy. Abby, what I'm trying to say is that when you were very little, you did not choose yourself instead of God and church. You chose yourself and God instead of church. When you chose yourself, you chose God. When you walked away from church, you took God with you. God is in you. And tonight, you, me, and God, we're just visiting church. We three came back for a visit to offer the folks here hope by telling stories about brave people like you who fight their whole lives to stay as whole and free as God made them. When we're done tonight, you and I will go, and God will go with us. I thought you'd looked at me every way possible. But now, the way you look at me in this minister's office is new. Eyes wide, watery and red. The minister disappeared when you looked at me like that. Just you, me, and God there. "Wow," you said. Like that time your G necklace got a knot in it. You stood there by the bed, grumbling, threatening to throw it away. I asked you for the chain, held it in my hand. Almost invisible, delicate white gold, impossible. You left. I kept at it for a while, impressing myself with my patience. And then, one tug in the right place, it all came undone. You walked back into our room. I held it up, proud. "Wow," you said. You bent down and I clasped it back around you. I kissed your cheek. May we lay more elegant ideas around our children's necks. Decals. When I was a young mother, exhausted, isolated, and dripping with children, I got a postcard from a local church offering free babysitting during the service. My then husband and I attended the following Sunday and found coffee, breakfast, music, a nursery, inspiring speakers, and welcoming couples everywhere. This church had identified every challenge in a young family's life and fixed them all for an hour. It felt like heaven, at first. Then one Sunday, the preacher started discussing the sins of homosexuality and abortion as if they were the pillars upon which this church was built. My insides caught fire. After the service, I contacted the preacher and set up a meeting. I asked him, "Why, if your church is based on the Jesus who spoke incessantly about orphans and widows, demilitarization, immigrants,
the sick, the outcast, and the poor, are you choosing abortion and gayness to hang your hat upon? After many circular arguments, he looked at me, sighed, and smiled. He said, "You are a smart woman. What you say makes sense in the ways of the world, but God's ways are not our ways. You must not lean on your own understanding. You seem to have a good heart, but the heart is fickle. Faith is about trusting. Do not think. Do not feel. Do not know. Mistrust your own heart and mind, and trust us. That is faith." He wanted me to believe that trusting him was trusting God, but he was not my connection to God. My heart and mind were my connections to God. If I shut those down, I'd be trusting the men who led this church instead of trusting God. I'd be relying on their understanding. The thing that gets me thinking and questioning most deeply is a leader who warns me not to think or question. I won't passively outsource my faith and my children's faith to others. I am a mother, and I have responsibilities to all children, not just my own. When hate or division is being spread in our religious institutions, we have three choices. Number one, remain quiet, which means we agree. Number two, loudly challenge power and work like hell to make change. Number three, take our families and leave. But there is no more silently disagreeing while poison is being pumped from pulpits and seeping beneath our children's skin. So many parents have come to me and said, "My kid just told me she's gay. We've been sitting in this church for a decade. How must she have felt hearing what our leaders thought of her and assuming her mother agreed? How do I undo what she heard there? How do I convince her that I never really agreed with any of it and that she's perfect just the way she is?" The God memos we get as kids are carved into our hearts. They are hard as hell to buff out. Everybody owes it to herself, to her people, to the world, to examine what she's been taught to believe, especially if she's going to choose beliefs that condemn others. She has to ask herself questions like, "Who benefits from me believing this?" After that preacher told me to quit thinking, I began thinking harder. I did my research. Turns out the memo he was trying to pass me, "A good Christian bases her faith on disapproving of gays and abortion," started being issued only 30 years ago. In the 1970s, a few rich, powerful, white, outwardly straight, men got worried about losing their right to continue racially segregating their private Christian schools and maintaining their tax-exempt status. Those men began to feel their money and power being threatened by the civil rights movement. In order to regain control, they needed to identify an issue that would be emotional and galvanizing enough to unite and politically activate their evangelical followers for the first time. They decided to focus on abortion. Before then, a full 6 years after the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, the prevailing evangelical position was that life began with the baby's first breath, at birth. Most evangelical leaders had been indifferent to the court's decision in Roe, and some were cited as supporting the ruling. Not anymore. They wrote a new memo using freshly feigned outrage and rhetoric, calling for a holy war to lead the nation back to the moral stance that made America great. They sponsored a meeting of 15,000 pastors called the Religious Roundtable to train pastors on how to convince their congregations to vote for anti-choice, anti-gay candidates. This is how they disseminated the memo down to evangelical ministers who passed it down to pews across America. The memo read, "To be aligned with Jesus, to have family values, to be moral, one must be against abortion and gay people and vote for the candidate that is anti-abortion and anti-gay." Presidential candidate Ronald Reagan, who, as governor of California, had signed into law one of the most liberal abortion laws in the country, began using the language from the new memo. Evangelicals threw their weight behind him and voted in a block for the first time to elect President Reagan. the religious right was born. The face of the movement was the pro-life and pro-family values stance of millions. But the blood running through the movement's veins was the racism and greed of a few. That is how white evangelicals became the most powerful and influential voting bloc in the United States and the fuel of the American white supremacy engine. That's how evangelical leaders get away with the stunning hypocrisy of keeping their money, racism, misogyny, classism, nationalism, weapons, war, and corruption, while purporting to lead in the name of a man who dedicated his life to ending war, serving orphans and widows, healing the sick, welcoming immigrants, prioritizing women and children, and giving power and money away to the poor. That is also why all a political candidate must do to earn evangelical allegiance is claim to be anti-abortion and anti-gay. Even if the candidate is a man who hates and abuses women, who stockpiles money and rejects immigrants, who incites racism and bigotry, who lives in every way antithetical to Jesus' teachings. Jesus, the cross, and the identity pro-life are just shiny decals evangelical leaders slap on top of their own interests. They just keep pushing the memo, don't think, don't feel, don't know. Just be against abortion and gays and keep on voting. That's how to live like Jesus. All the devil has to do to win is convince you he's God. My evangelical friends insist to me that their opposition to abortion and queerness was born in them. They are sincere and convinced. But I wonder. We all believe our religious beliefs were written on our hearts and in the stars. We never stop to consider that most of the memos we live by were actually written by highly motivated men. I don't know if I call myself a Christian anymore. That label suggests certainty, and I have none. It suggests the desire to convert others, and that's the last thing I want to do. It suggests exclusive belonging, and I'm not sure I belong anywhere anymore. Part of me wants to peel that label off, set it down, and try to meet each person soul to soul, without any layers between us. But I find myself unable to let go fully, because to wash my hands of the Jesus story is to abandon something beautiful to money-hungry hijackers. It would be like surrendering the concept of beauty to the fashion industry or the magic of sexuality to internet porn dealers. I want beauty. I want sex. I want faith. I just don't want the hijackers' commodified, poisonous versions. Nor do I want to identify myself with hijackers. So I will say this. I remain compelled by the Jesus story. Not as history meant to reveal what happened long ago, but as poetry meant to illuminate a revolutionary idea powerful enough to heal and free humanity now. On the storytellers who wrote about that revolutionary idea, there was a time on Earth, like every other time on Earth, when humanity had turned against itself. A few hoarded unspeakable riches while children starved. People raped and robbed and enslaved one another and waged wars against one another for power and money. There were a few, there are always a few, wise enough to see this order of things as unjust, untrue, and unbeautiful. They saw that killing one another for money is absurd because what lies within each person is more valuable than gold. They saw that slavery and hierarchy are evil because no one is born more worthy of freedom and power than another. They saw that violence and greed destroy the powerful just as they destroy their victims, because to dishonor another's humanity is to bury one's own. They saw that humanity's only hope for salvation was the truer, more beautiful order of things. They asked themselves, what kind of story might help people see beyond the lie they've been taught that some are worth less and others more? What kind of story might return people to their wild, to what they knew of love before they were trained to fear one another? What kind of story might inspire people to revolt against and live beyond the religiously dominated hierarchical machine that was killing them? Here was their idea. Let's rethink the stories we've been telling about God. Let's dare to imagine that God is less like the powerful men who run the world. Let's imagine God is actually like the person those rulers just killed. Let's imagine that God is a vulnerable baby born to a poor single mother among the group most despised by the religious and political elite. He was the least of these back then. They pointed to him. God is in him, they said. Had these wise storytellers lived in modern America, they might point to a poor, black, transgender woman or an asylum-seeking toddler alone in a detainment center and say, God is in this one. This one. The one on the outermost ring of the rankings we've made up about who matters. This one. The one farthest from whom we have centered. This one is made of our same flesh, blood, and spirit. When we hurt her, we hurt our own kin. This one is one of us. This one is us. So let us protect her. Let us bring her gifts and kneel in front of her. Let us fight for her and her family to have every good thing we want for ourselves and our families. Let us love this one as we love ourselves. The point of this story was never that this one is more God than the rest. The point is that if we can find good in those we've been trained to see as bad, if we can find worth in those we've been conditioned to see as worthless, if we can find ourselves in those we've been indoctrinated to see as other, then we become unable to hurt them. When we stop hurting them, we stop hurting ourselves. When we stop hurting ourselves, we begin to heal. The Jesus idea is that justice casts the widest net possible so that every last one of us is inside. Then there are no others. There is only us. Inside one net, we are free from our cages of fear and hate and instead bound to one another. The revolutionary idea that every last one of us is both held and free, that is our salvation. Girl Gods. Glennon, you refer to God as she. Why do you believe that God's a female? I don't. I think it's ridiculous to think of God as anything that could possibly be gendered. But as long as the expression of God as female is unimaginable to many, while the expression of God as male feels perfectly acceptable, and as long as women continue to be undervalued and abused and controlled here on earth, I'll keep using it. Conflicts. I received an email recently from an old acquaintance at that church I left. It said, "Can I ask you something? I know that you and Abby love each other so much. It's really something. At the same time, I still believe that gayness is wrong. I want to be able to love you unconditionally, but I'd have to abandon my beliefs. What am I supposed to do with this God conflict?" I felt for her. She was saying, "I want to be free to love you, but I'm caged by my beliefs." I wrote this back. First of all, thank you for knowing that you have a choice to make. Thank you for not landing on, "I love you, but..." We know that love has no buts. If you want to change me, you do not love me. If you feel warm toward me but also believe I'm going to burn in hell, you do not love me. If you wish me well but vote against my family being protected by the law, you do not love me. Thank you for understanding that to love me as yourself means to want for me and my family every good thing you want for yourself and your family. Anything less than that is less than love. So yes, I agree that you have a choice to make. You have to choose between loving me and keeping your beliefs. Thank you for being intellectually honest about that. Second, I understand this conflict because I've experienced it. I still do. For a while, I felt scared because I thought the God conflict was me challenging God. Now I know that it was God in me challenging religion. It was my true self awakening and saying, wait, this thing I have been taught to believe about God, about myself, about others, it doesn't jibe with what I know from my roots about love. What do I do? Do I reject what I know from my roots or what I was taught to believe? I can only tell you what I have come to know for myself. Returning to ourselves is confusing at first. It's not as simple as listening for the voices inside of us, because sometimes the voices inside of us, which we've assumed speak truth, are just the voices of human beings who told us what to believe. Often the internal voice telling us who God is and what God approves of is not God. It's our indoctrination. It's an echo of the voice of a teacher, a parent, a preacher, someone who has claimed to represent God to us. Many of those people have been well-meaning and others have only sought to control us. Either way, not a single one of them has been God's appointed spokesperson. Not a single one of them has more God in her than you do. There is no church that owns God. There is no religion that owns God. There are no gatekeepers. None of this is that easy. There is no outsourcing your faith. There is just you and God. Some of the hardest and most important work of our lives is learning to separate the voices of teachers from wisdom, propaganda from truth, fear from love, and in this case, the voices of God's self-appointed representatives from the voice of God herself. When choosing between something you know and something other people taught you to believe, choose what you know. As Whitman said, re-examine all you have been told in school, in church, or in any book, and dismiss whatever insults your own soul. Having the courage to dismiss what insults your soul is a matter of life or death. If those who claim to speak for God or truth can convince you to believe instead of know, to live from their rules instead of your roots, to trust the voices of middlemen instead of the still small voice inside you, then they control you. If they can get you to mistrust yourself, to stop feeling, deny knowing, quit imagining, and instead rely only on them, then they can get you to act against your own soul. If that happens, they can get you to follow them, vote with them, condemn for them, even kill for them, all in the name of this God who is constantly whispering to you, that is not exactly it. Perhaps the God